Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. Today's guest is a USA Today bestselling author of historical romance. She's reviewed books for NPR, and in her spare time, quote unquote, she writes passionate defenses of the romance genre. Please welcome Maya Rodale.
Hi, it's so nice to be here with you.
I'm so excited that you're here. I feel like you've been on my list for a long time because I love to talk to historical people. If I had my druthers, it would be 763 people to write historical romance, and I feel like that would not be as accessible to the wide audience of romance land. Although I know you actually do write more than just historical romance, but like I think that's probably, do you feel like that's kind of where you're the best known?
Oh, for sure. I live pretty firmly in either historical romance or historical fiction or generally olden times.
Yeah. The olden times. I enjoy the olden times. I had said to my group the other day that like I would want to visit the Regency, but I feel like I like showering too much to want to live there.
For sure. Showering, pants, having your own money.
Oh my God, yeah, pants. I would miss pants. I would miss my phone because I feel like it's like an attachment now to my head. But like I would be sitting there going like, why can't I play like Manor Matters? Right. That's how I decompress, Your Grace. Like, he would be like, I don't understand what that means.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like I'd be like a quick in and out visitor. And what was funny was most of the readers were kind of the same way. Like, there were a couple of people that were like, yeah, I would want to totally live there. But most people were like, yeah, no, I would not want to live there.
No.
So as much as like we like the olden times, like I don't think I like where we are now. Mostly.
I want to make postcards that say the Regency, a nice place to visit. Well, it's funny. I have a book coming out that's a body swapping where a modern girl goes to Regency times and a Regency wallflower comes to modern times and they have to like deal.
Yeah. And I love that. Like kind of like the, what is that? The, not the Parent Trap. It's the other one where they switch
Freaky
bodies.
Friday.
Freaky Friday. Freaky Friday. It's, that's like a YA, right? Isn't that? Is that YA?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's YA. And there's romances in it, but it's not strictly romance. But it's just like a female friendship love story. But also, oh
Freaky
my God,
Friday.
How do you survive the Regency?
Right.
How do you survive now?
Right, because, I mean, yeah, the opposite would absolutely be true. You know, you think about, like, someone coming from a time where none, like, almost none of the structure of society that we have now existed. They would be so confused. Like, what are these things that are the carriages that are moving so fast that have no horses? Why are you attached to your, what is that thing in your hand? A phone? What is that? I mean, like, you just think about things that we don't even think about, running water and, you know, easy access to things and, you know, not having to be tailored and, you know, all that stuff. Like, all of that would be so confusing. Like, every single aspect of life would be completely confusing.
Completely confusing. And my favorite thing was, so going into that character's mindset and like kind of experiencing that as I wrote, but the Regency girl, she's like, when is the maid coming? Why is this
so
room
confused.
A mess? Who's fixing it?
Why is no one making this bed? Which, to be honest, sometimes I wonder that too.
I know.
Like, why hasn't the bed made itself?
Right.
Please tell me. It would be. I mean, there is something sort of nice about the idea of like someone like sweeping in and just like everything is sort of taken care of. I mean, there's like a huge amount of privilege to that, but there is a, like there's a nice, this is a nice feeling to think like someone else would just take care of things and I would just clap my hands and it would be done. And I wouldn't have to plan dinner every night.
Oh my God.
Doesn't it feel like all we're doing is like a friend of mine posted like, now I'm cooking 463 meals a day, and that's totally what it feels like.
Yeah.
Like, we never escape it. I need that Regency you know, cook and housekeeper
who just serves food. I was like, maybe approve the menu. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and gives me two choices and that's it. Like I don't want to choose. I just want food to arrive.
I'm the same way. I spent so much time like thinking of it and planning for it, and especially when you're doing it for like everyone's different
dietary and
preferences. So my New Year's resolution this year is like, I'm not asking my family anymore. You're just getting what I want.
It builds character.
It's
let them build character.
Let them build character or like get their own brain space for it. Like, it's the brain space that gets me.
Yeah, it really is. And I think as writers, like, because this is obviously, this is an issue I also have. So for the new year, you know, they do those like HelloFresh and Blue Apron. And, hey, anybody want to host, you know, like sponsor this podcast? I totally use both of those things. But like, so I bought into like two different boxes so I don't have to think about dinner, because I feel like it's like those little things that creep into my creative time. Like, mm-hmm. it's like a weird thing, right? Like, I mean, obviously the big things creep in, but like the little things feel like they add up. I don't know if you feel the same way. Like all those little tiny, like minutia chores or whatever, minutia things, like I feel like they whittle on a different level of my creative energy.
They absolutely do. And I think protecting your, when a writer protecting their brain space and their energy is one of the hardest battles we fight. Cause it's like, you have to make a doctor's appointment. It's 20 minutes gone on hold, right? Yeah. What are you having for dinner? Do you have all the groceries you need? What's happening with like the dry cleaning? I don't know. Everyone's got their own.
I get settled in minutia. And then the dog needs to go for a walk, or yeah. I mean, everybody has a different minutia. It depends on if you have, you know, like
kids,
a pet or kids, or yeah. like a job outside of writing, like a second job or a first mm-hmm. job, and writing is the second job. Like, but all of it just creeps in. And then we sit there and go, how come I'm not writing? How come I'm not finishing? How come I'm not, you know, being as fast as this other person, you know, is a lot, because I'm pretty fast. So people are, why, you know, why? Well, it's like, because I don't have kids and I don't, you know, I mean, I have, like, yeah. I don't have a job outside of that. But I mean, like, like, I don't have a lot of those external things. But I mean, like, it is, right. it is really funny watching people be like, why is it so hard? And then when you ask them about their life, it's like, well, I have three children, a full-time job outside of writing, you know, a sick parent that I'm taking care of. And you're right. like, well, I'm kind of feeling like there's the answer. Like, you have a lot of outside influences that whittle away from creative time.
Exactly. And then if you have free time on your calendar, people are like, well, you're free. Like, there's yeah. nothing on Saturday. But it's like, no, I need, I don't know about you, but like a block of time free to write. Like, I need 3 hours, and I'll only write for one, probably be actively typing.
Yeah.
But I need to feel that space that I can relax into it.
Yeah. And so. For me, like, I don't feel comfortable until I'm done with whatever the goal is. I know lots of people count words, or like I count pages. Like, if I have a goal for the day and I'm not done, like, I have to, like, I feel uncomfortable until it's finished.
Yeah. What's your job?
Yes. Like, I, you know, like everything else I can push around the plate, but that is the thing that I feel like I can't. And so, yeah, I need that block of time when, you know, if I have to go to an appointment, which that doesn't really exist so much anymore, but occasionally, like, I do have to leave this house and go somewhere and see another human, God forbid, in person, yeah. masked, 17 masks deep. But like, right. I like that. That takes so much emotional energy. Like, I have to get ready and I have to get dressed and maybe I have to put makeup on, and then I have to get in the car, and then I have to drive, and then I have to go there, and I have to sit in because I'm early, so now I'm sitting in the office, and then I have to do the thing, and then I have to come back, and then it's like you have to get back in that headspace. And mm-hmm. it's, I mean, I think we discount a lot. Like, we believe that we should be like robotically getting into it, but you're doing a creative endeavor and it takes a different kind of headspace.
It really does.
So were you always a big reader before you got into the headspace of writing?
Yes, I have always been a big reader. Thank God.
Yeah.
And I'm really lucky, like, my husband and I have the same idea of a good time, which is reading quietly next to each other.
That's nice. But like, it matches, because some people don't have that same thing, and so yeah, it's like,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and but I was a late reader of romance. I didn't start.
Yeah, you in your 20s. Bio, I saw that like your mom sort of insisted you read it during college. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So yeah, I was majoring in like women and fiction as writers and characters, because like I always gravitated towards, you know, girl stories. Like, I loved The Babysitter's Club, and then I would read Madame Bovary, and then I was like, where, somewhere between those two things.
Right. Those are very disparate ends of the spectrum.
I was reading them at different ages.
Yes.
Anne of Green Gables. Yeah. Yeah. Anne of Green Gables was an early favorite. And then I always loved like the girl stories in English classes and fiction. So I was really studying women in fiction as writers and characters. And my mom was like, you have to read romance. And I was like, no, I don't want to. But then she talked me into it. And obviously, we fell in love, me and romance, yeah. and are living happily ever after most That's of the
so,
time.
So nice.
Yeah.
So were you writing at a young age before you were reading romance? But like, were you always kind of interested in writing?
Yes. I didn't think of myself as a writer until like college, mm-hmm. when I thought fiction writing classes would be easy homework because you could just make it up.
Everyone it who's like, not a writer right now went, what? And every writer went, yeah, right. No, that makes total sense.
Yeah. Or I loved like creative nonfiction autobiography because I was like, I'll just write about boys.
Clearly you were on a path.
Clearly on a path. And so I started that way, and then I learned up like, yes, you can just make it up, but there's a lot of crafting that goes into it, and you work it and work it and work it. But I really enjoyed the work, and there's a lot of stuff in life I enjoy doing, but not a lot that I'm willing to put the work in to get better at.
Yeah.
So writing is one of the things, but I had to laugh because a few years ago, my mom handed me like a massive plastic bin with like every piece of paper I'd ever drawn on in my whole life.
Oh my gosh.
And she was like, deal with this.
Now it's your problem.
Yeah. Get it out of my basement. But I found in it like a handwritten story. I must have been like 10 maybe, but it was like the accident in the ballroom, and it was like a princess and something else. I'm like, okay, this was no accident. I ended up where I am.
That's probably, she was probably thinking in her head, like, she's gonna find romance by herself. She's not finding it. Here, just take it. She has not found it yet. Just give it to her. Cause like, yeah, that's great. That's really funny. Was it a very romancy story? Or just a ballroom story?
I mean, I was 10, so like.
Right. 10-year-old romance.
10-year-old romance. I believe like a prince showed up. I have to dig this out. I'm going to dig it out. But yeah, I just the royalty and the ballroom and the like drama happening in that setting, I thought was very foreshadowy. Use the technical term.
yeah the technical term of foreshadowing. Yeah. I had posted forever ago on my blog when I was still blogging on my website. It was called The Beautiful Woman, was a story I'd written in, ooh, I don't know, like fifth grade. And like, she was very beautiful, but she was very sad. And then the hero showed up, ooh, with a puppy, and that solved it. And I was like, so romantic. He's giving her gifts that really speak to her. And as I was reading it, I was like, yeah, this was totally, you know, preordained that this was going to be my life. And I had also written something where like, you know, a lady had gone somewhere and she had like a black veil, and it was like, but it was contemporary. I was like, who the fuck wears a black veil? Like, what was I doing? Like, it's just roaming around in like modern times wearing a black veil. That's what I mean. That's a Tuesday for me, but like for most people.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, it was really funny when you look back and you go, oh, yeah, no, this was, yeah, I was going to do this always. Exactly. So how did you sort of start taking that more seriously and kind of transition into writing for a more, like, for the purpose of, like, thinking about publication or, you know, how did you, you know, because, like, writing those little stories, it was always fun, but I never thought that was for all, like, evidence to the contrary, I didn't think people actually wrote for a living, even though I was reading books that people were actively writing for a living. Right. So, like, how did you go, oh, this could be a job?
That's like, that's a really interesting question. Because, yeah, how do you make that leap of, like, oh, people actually do this? How do you get published once you've written a thing? So when I was in college, my mom had this idea to do a self-help book, and I was like, I'm going to do that with you. So, what the hell did I know at 22? So that was really precious of me. But we did this self-help book together. And it was all about like what we can learn from other women and women in history about how to live like happy, authentic lives full of like pleasure and truth and goodness and just how to live well. So I worked on that with her, and we got an agent and we got a book deal. And it has to be noted that at the time, my family had a publishing company. So I did know people like.
Yeah, you had some connection. Yeah.
I had some good. So we did this, and then it was right at the end of college. And then we were writing the book over like that summer. I had just gotten out of college, I think. And I was like, this is a great job. I do, like, I go to yoga and go to a cafe and write, and people gave me money, and like, I got to make this work. And then that was easier said than done because, you know, the book came out, it was a non-event, as often sadly happens with books. And yeah. I, meanwhile, had like, was reading romance voraciously, and I was like, I'm going to switch to romance. And my agent was like, you should switch to romance. And so I wrote this thing, and 12 out of 12 agents agreed. It was completely unsellable. So I was like, wait a minute. I thought I was going to do this. But I apparently was not. And so then I had that like hard year most people have post-college where like I was hostessing in a restaurant and like writing and just like being like, wait, what the hell do I do now?
Right. Because so, it looks like from the outside, like you go to college and then you get a job. And like, that's not really the way that it works anymore. So it's like, who the hell am I, you know, after college? Like, what am I? What am I doing?
What am I doing?
Who is this person that I live inside the body of?
Exactly. What, like, how do you life?
How do you life? I'm still trying to figure it out.
I know. When you figure it out, let me know.
Yeah, I'll post it. We'll do a self-help book, and it'll probably be a non-event, to be honest with you.
Everyone's just making it up is the thing. So I did what people do in that time, which is I applied to grad school. So I had this like year of getting rejected for books, getting rejected from grad school. And it was like a really hard, dark year for me. But at the end of it, I got into grad school and I got a 2-book deal from Berkeley to write romance novels. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of like turned stuff around for me. And I have to say, like, there's so much privilege in my story, right? Yeah. Like, I could afford to do this. I could afford to go to grad school because I didn't know. I had like a background in publishing. And even though I didn't know people in the fiction space, I still knew how the game was played. I still knew how to approach someone or how to tailor a book proposal. So I had every advantage, and I'm very lucky and did nothing to deserve it. But I try to pay it forward. So
I'm sure you did some things to deserve it, like writing a great book.
I wrote the book.
But no. I mean, you're right, because it is something that, like, we talk about it a lot. Like, when you speak to people outside of publishing, outside of romance land, and you talk about what you do, the response you get is usually like the blank stare of like, I don't understand literally any word that just came out of your mouth. It's like you're speaking a different language. And it's a language that most of us have to learn when we start seriously pursuing a career in romance fiction, especially if you want to do traditional publishing. But even if you want to do indie publishing, like, that language exists.
That's so much to learn.
And it's so much to learn. It's such a heavy learning curve. So having that little bit of knowledge, or, you know, moderate amount of knowledge about just how publishing works, puts you ahead of the curve for sure.
Yeah. So I was so lucky to have that and to be a quick study of it, to pitch my novels. And I was like, here's a good book that I wrote and labored over and took lots of RWA workshops to like develop my craft over. But like, here's how you can publisher like market it. Here's how it fits in. Like,
yeah.
Because the first book I wrote that I got 12 out of 12 rejections, like, it was a fun story, couldn't be marketed or sold. So I learned. So I wrote the book. I went to grad school, and I wrote through grad school, and I did my first 2 books, and then I got another book deals. I moved over to Avon at that time. And then finally, after grad school, I got a job. And so I was always like grad school or writing or working or writing. And then it was when I was around 30, I think, that I was able to write full time.
Yeah.
But that's, yeah, the rough outlines of how I became a writer. I think like I just did it is the other thing.
Yeah.
And like from the beginning, I was getting up at like 5 and other unholy hours and just putting words on the page and then going over it again and again and again. So I do want to give myself that credit for really working at it.
And I mean, you know, you're completely or almost completely traditionally published, right? I mean, all the romance is traditional, or do you have some
projects? I've done some anthologies self-published, and my upcoming book is self-published. So I've dabbled with it, and I've dabbled with it enough to know it's amazing, and it's so much harder than people think.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it's, so. And I think the thing that it isn't really for everyone. Like there's certain, like if you don't want to control every aspect of every part of it, and then it won't work. You know what right. I mean? Like that is the key thing, you know? I mean, and so again, I mean, I think it's, these knee jerk responses that we sometimes have where it's like, do you want to do this? And for a lot of people, they're like, yeah, of course. It's like, but do you really want to do it? Like, yeah. I mean, now that it's an option, which is awesome, because when I started I published with Avon for the first time, and my first book with them came out in 2005. That was it. Like, that was the option. You know, I mean, you could do a traditional publisher. There were a few small presses that didn't have necessarily the distribution, mm-hmm. you know, that some of those small presses have now. And you could do sort of vanity press or independent publishing, but there was no distribution, and you had to sort of, the hustle of it was like even more intense than the hustle is now. And you could pretty much just kind of sell books out of your car, you know?
Right.
And so that space didn't exist to have that option. But I mean, you know, it's like now that I love that there's that option, and that you can kind of look down this, you know, this list of from anywhere from like the most traditional publishing to something kind of in between, to something that's like fully you, and that everybody has that option. But I mean, I think there are pros and cons to everything.
Yeah. I think overall self-publishing existing is a really great thing for the world.
I wouldn't be writing anymore if I was still traditionally published. I would have quit for sure.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah. I mean, my traditional publishing, I've been very vocal about it. It was not like the greatest experience for me. And so like, this is much better for my personality, but I like being in control of every aspect of everything. And my husband works for me full time. So again, privileged, like he gets to control a lot of us. I'm like, this is broken. Please fix. Bye. And he does. You know, that's great. You know, like he sort of deals with a lot of that stuff that allows me to do more of the creative side.
But that's great.
Yeah, it makes it. It's very nice. But again, that's like a huge, like massive level of privilege, is having someone that like full time. That's his full time actual job he gets paid for, is to work on those things, you know. And but again, like that would not have existed in, you know, 2005. So 16 right. years ago now. Oh, my God, I'm so old. But, you know, I mean, but that having those options makes it a much more interesting space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does.
What is your process now? Are you, you know, what, how do you sort of go from here's an idea to here's a book, Avon or whoever, like, please publish.
Money, please.
Yeah, please write check. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Here's some words. My process is like remarkably unchanged, where I just get up at like 5, sometimes 5:30, and I like to write 1,000 words before breakfast. Mm-hmm. And I write incredibly sloppy. Like I won't finish sentences. I'll just TK. I'll write like dialogue only. I try to write a few thousand words per day. I found like 2,000 words a day is like enough of a pace for me that I can write my manuscript, but then also do all the other crap that I can't pay my husband to do. So that an author, a working author, needs to do. So that's what I do. And then I end up with like maybe like a 50,000, 60,000 word draft that's like an almost unreadable mess, but I can see who the characters are, how the plot hangs together.
You can see the path of it.
I can see the path of it. And then I'll make my husband read it. And then,
oh, in that state? Oh, does he enjoy that? Or I mean, he must, because he keeps doing it. So
enough. Yeah. I mean, there, it's, I'll finish the sentences at that point. Like, it'll be a really rough, like, I won't go into character descriptions necessarily, or what the dress she was wearing was like.
Right. You're really getting the plot and the kind of basic character, not like you said, not the character description, but like, who is the character? You kind of have those. I mean, those would be the things you would get in that sort of rough draft, right?
Right. What's their voice? What's their motivation? Does this make sense? So then he reads it and gives it me feedback. And the feedback is always to do more with the hero's relationship with his father. And then I tell him, no one's reading romance for that. And then we have a fight. But then, like, ultimately, like, he helps me figure some stuff out, and I ignore some of what he says and take some of it, and I finish the draft. And then it goes to an editor, and then I do a really significant revision once I get my editor's notes. And then at a certain point, I just never want to see it again.
Yeah. So I reach that point too. Like, you get to, like, usually for me, it's like in the copy edity sort of stage when I've seen it 35 times, it feels like, even though it's not 35 times, but it feels like it. And I just want to, like, kill everybody. And I'm like, can I do a revision where they just die?
Yeah.
Because I hate them.
Exactly.
But the nice thing is, if I have had enough space in between the last time I've seen it, then I don't feel that way so much. But I'm an indie publishing, like, and I'm a fast writer, so I never really get the space where I'm like, oh yeah, I like them again. No, I just hate them. Right. I'm dead.
Right. But then it helps you move on to the next story.
Yeah. By that time, your head is in the next thing. So it's like,
yeah,
I don't.
So wait, how much do you write per day?
So I still count by pages because I'm old. So it usually ends up probably being 2,500 on an average. 2,500 words probably is probably about right. Like, because it's about 12 pages. So if you figure it's like 2,500, 2,800, something a day. And then there are days when I, like, just go crazy because I'm close to the end and I do a lot more than that. But on average, it's probably that. And I do that consistently 5 days a week. So I write, like, you know, 6-7 books a year and publish 6 usually. So, but again, like, I get to have that freedom because Avon would never. That was part of, like, Avon was like, please stop. We'll publish a book every, like, 9 months. And I'm like, oh no, that's like, once I had that option, I was like, I gotta go though.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe this isn't the right fit for me, which it wasn't, so it's fine,
right?
Because again, everybody has a different thing. So
yeah.
But again, I mean, you know, this is 100% what I do. And I have this other, you know, person that's sort of working. He does the publishing end for me. So I still have a publisher.
That's great.
It's just, yeah, it makes it a lot easier. So, and you said that process hasn't changed really much over time. That's kind of the same way that it was from the beginning. How did, like, because, like, when you have that super rough draft, I think when you're a younger writer and you don't know that that's your process, it would be very easy to look at that and be like, what the hell am I doing? Right. Versus now I would assume that after so many books, you're like, no, this is just what I do. So how do you, think you sort of became comfortable with that?
I think I did come to it like a few books in, because what would happen is I would like write pretty thoroughly and cleanly. And then I would get 3/4 of the way in and be like, oh, there's a massive plot hole.
Yeah.
And there's, or this is like an unsupportable plot, or like something is grievously wrong in the foundation of this.
Yeah.
And when you have that many words, like,
it's hard to just, because you have to de-thread it then. And that's hard.
Yeah. And so, like, I see sometimes now in people's first books, and like, I've written this, we've all written this book, where it's like, you're learning and you're like, okay, in this draft, this motivation changed, but then that action doesn't make sense. And this, like, you're forcing it to fit. And so my workaround for that was...
to make it so loose that you hadn't... it was easy to sort of fix those things. Yeah.
Exactly. I only in the past few books discovered writing a synopsis before.
What? So does that mean that sounds very plotty. So, I mean, are you a plotter, or do you consider yourself a pantser, or something in between? I mean, if you're writing a synopsis, you must be at least sort of in between something.
Yeah, I'm a plotter, or I like a mostly plotter. Mm-hmm. Because I really love, as I write, when like stuff comes up to me where I'm like, oh, I didn't realize they would have this feeling here, or that this would inspire that. So I'm trying to get to be less of a plotter, but I swear by like the beat sheets,
yeah,
or things like that. I think they help tremendously.
Because yeah, they sort of feel like they establish where the path goes, even if the road, you don't know exactly like where the twists and turns in the road are.
Exactly. And like, I just read The Heroine's Journey by Gail Carriger, mm-hmm, and highly recommend this book. And I'm just like shocked that I, given my background, had never heard The Heroine's Journey. And so I've been plotting all these like romance novels to like a movie beat sheet or like The Hero's Journey and all this stuff. And like, you make it work. But then I found finally Her Heroine's Journey. I was like, oh, this makes so much more sense for what I'm trying to do. So I'm very, and then I went back and reworked what I was working on, and it wasn't too hard because it wasn't too done. So that was a great find. But yeah, I'm very interested in plot and how it works, but I also know I need to be careful of making sure the motivation of the characters inspires the next action, yeah, and not just being like, they're going to a ball, something happens. They're going on a carriage ride, something happens. And predetermining too much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it sounds like if you don't have that elbow room to explore, that is not a great...
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it is, and this is one of the things, and you and I kind of talked about this for a second before we started recording, but that's one of the things I really love about doing this podcast is, like, seeing how many different ways there are. Because there are people that they plot it, like, down to the, you know, the thread where it's like, she is wearing a blue gown on page 73. You know what I mean? Like they get really granular, like down to everything. And that makes them really excited because they know the path, exactly the path. And then they, yeah, write something. And I mean, you know, sometimes it's super clean, sometimes it's not, but like, you know, they need every single moment. And then there's people that they can't have any moment. Like they can't know anything, or else they just get bored because they've already written it in their head then, and it's not right, interesting anymore. You know, and then there's like kind of those in between people, and there's such a wide range of what in between is, which I think is so cool.
It's so cool. And then every book is different.
Yeah.
So I have this fantasy that I'm going to be one of those plotters and just go over it so much in my head and have a synopsis. And then I'm just going to sit down and write like 2000 perfect words a day until it's done. And it never happens. But, I think one of the best things that has happened to me as I've aged and I've done this for so long is I've become so understanding and forgiving. So I'm like, oh, this is the part where you feel like it's hopeless and you can't even, and you're just spinning your wheels, but like you just write through this and it'll be better next week. And knowing that about my process and being like, it's a mess now, you're going to fix it, you always do, allows me to just move through it more. So I'm really grateful for
and
that.
I love that we're seeing that said more, you know. I mean, I think that like kind of that individualization of what we do is a much more common conversation than I think it was 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. I mean, mm-hmm, it's really easy to go into, because there's 5,000 classes, right? I mean, even now, there's like 5,000 classes. And there's lots of people that say, look, this may not work for you. This, you know, this may not be your thing. But there's also people that they're like, this is the way that you do it. And I think, yeah, when you're young in your career, you know, early in your career, I think it is very easy to think that there's only one way. And if you get stuck in that loop, like it's very easy to get discouraged because you're fighting against a, you know, a stream, you know, I mean, you want,
right,
it wants to push you this way and you're like, but I have to go this way. And, and so I mean, I love that more people are talking about that we all have those moments. Like, I mean, Michael will laugh at me when we talk about it because I'll be like, oh my God, I'm the worst. And he's like, so what are you at? Like 60%. I'm like, shut up. Go away. He's like, you know, when you get to 73%, you'll be fine. I'm like, thank you. I don't want to talk to you anymore. We are enemies to lovers. you are not my friend. But like, he is my friend, right? Because he like recognizes yeah. that's my, you know, that that's my process. And you're right. Like that takes, and I feel like that takes time to learn what that is, because yours might be at, you know, 42% and mine's at 61%, right. You know, and again, you're right. Like it also may change with a book. Like there are some books where it is just an absolute slog from beginning to end. And I hate every freaking moment of it. Like the whole thing is terrible. It doesn't happen very often, thank God. But like every once in a while, you just have one of those slog books where you're like, this is just uphill the whole time.
Exactly. With the wind, like
in your face, in 45 miles an hour and freezing cold.
Yeah. I like will not miserable. Tell the title of that book for me. But
I have too many of the title of that book.
Yeah.
Yeah. We all have it. And again, like, I mean, because you've written enough books, because you've been in the industry long enough, like, you know that. And if we have that conversation, we both go, yeah, it's, sometimes it's like that. And I think that every time that we say that, that means somebody that's new goes, oh, it's just like that? Oh, okay. Oh, thank God.
Yeah.
I thought I was just bad at this and I was going to quit.
Well, I had the most amazing experience in quarantine this year that I've never had before writing, where I was working on a project and it got really, really like hard and I wasn't sure about it and blah, 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 blah. But then for the first time in my like adult writing life, I wasn't under contract for it. So no one was expecting this book. And there was this one day where I was like, I don't have to do this. And so I stopped.
Wow. I don't even understand. Like trying to process that.
And
that's an option.
I'm kind of kicking myself because what it was about ended up being very true. And it was a contemporary. But I found it very hard to write a contemporary romance started pre-pandemic. That was once the pandemic hit. But it was a very interesting moment to just be like, I don't have to. Because everything I've written, I've otherwise very gratefully been under contract for. And that's also a really rewarding experience when you have those books that are hard, that are uphill with the wind in your face both ways. Getting through it is like amazing.
Yeah.
And to know you can finish it. And I think, you know, I want to say everybody has to do their own thing. There is no one right way, but a lot of what I see with like newer authors is like, they don't finish stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like if it's not your story, it's not the right story. Like,
and it's so hard because, right, because you want to give that advice of like, hey, just finish it. But then you also know that like sometimes it isn't something you should finish. And again, like the more that you learn, like there's plenty of times where I'm like, oh my God, this is such a good idea. And then I'm like, yeah, it doesn't have legs. Like I know it before I start. And so I don't start because I've learned that over time. Or I'm like, okay, that is a really good idea, but I need to fold it into 14 other things or else it's not a book. It's like a scene. Right. And I think, you know what I mean? And it looks like a book. It's a motivation. It's a thread of a motivation. It's not a book. Like it needs to have more than that. And again, I mean, that just comes, I think, with experience. And so, and really so it's hard. It's hard when you're giving someone, when someone is asking that question or, you know, you're looking at, cause like my first response is always like, well, just finish it. But you're right. Like sometimes it's not your story. It's not the story. It's not a story. And it's hard. It's such an ephemeral thing to know when it's just wrong and when you're just like in a hard spot.
Right. Right. And it's different every time. But this is one of the other things I love about self-publishing is like something, a spark of an idea. It may not be an Avon historical romance. It may not be a full length historical fiction novel. But it might make a really fantastic novella that you just want to write and put out there.
Yeah.
And so I love that there's a space to explore that, all those different stories, and it maybe doesn't feel like wasted effort.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't fit what's traditionally published or their word count requirements or something like that.
Well, and their threshold for what will work or what is successful is very different than your threshold as an individual, because, you know, we get such a higher percentage of royalty, you know, I mean, there's a lower overhead cost because I'm not paying for a, you know, a very, very swanky building in Manhattan.
Right, right.
At least not right at this moment. Maybe in the future. I don't know. I'll just buy a swanky building. It's fine. I'm sure that will totally happen. But like, I mean, because I don't have that overhead, because I don't have to pay all of those things, you know, I mean, that get factored into every single book that they publish is every single book they publish is paying for some portion of that. Plus an advance that they gave to someone that, you know, wrote like, you know, the Kim Kardashians of the world ghostwriting the book, like get a $4 million advance. Well, who pays for that? Like that's romance, you know, I mean, they may not ever make that money back. They almost always make the money back on most romances most of the time. So, I mean, you know, they have to have an overhead conversation that is very different than the overhead conversation I have to have. So I can tell something that I'm like, I know that this is going to be more niche. I know that this is not going to, you know, there are times when you know that those numbers aren't going to be the same, but I'm still going to make more money, or I'm still going to, you know, it's going to come out to where the math problem makes sense to me.
Right. Right. I love that. That's an opportunity and an option.
Do you consider yourself fast then? Because you're kind of doing those like multiple layers. I mean, obviously because you're, you know, you're publishing with a traditional publisher, like what will publish is not necessarily as fast or slow as like what you want. But
yeah,
I mean, like if you were to just be able to write as many books a year as you wanted, do you feel like that you're quick, or that you're, you know, because you have this process where you're going through multiple layers of revision, that, you know, that kind of changes the speed?
I think it changes the speed, and it's all relative, right? Like when I talk to non-writer friends, are like, oh my God, you do a book a year? And I'm like, yeah, I'm slow because you do six or seven. And someone else does 20 and someone does 2. And like,
yeah, it's such a range.
There's such a range. So,
yeah.
And that's one of those things where like, I've tried to get better myself, telling myself to just like let it go, that comparison and ranking, like comparing myself to others and their productivity and stuff like that.
No, it's a like super dangerous path because everyone's brain works so differently that like if you tried to, like if I tried to do one book a year, like you don't, like I feel itchy, it hurts
me. Yeah,
my mental health suffers. But if you were trying to do six books a year, your head would explode. So like everyone has their way.
And I've done years where I've like done 2.5 books, or like 2 books in an anthology, or and then I have years where I've done like 1, or you know, last year was a really weird year writing wise for me. So as long as I feel like I have projects I'm excited for that I'm working on, I really like that. And that will be lucrative. I like that. But I always have the temptation of like, oh God, I just want to do, I have so many ideas. I want to do all of the things.
And there's a lot of pressure in the current market.
I don't want to shortchange anything either.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, and I mean, that leads to an interesting question. I mean, you've written mostly historical romance as your fiction, but you've also written contemporary, and you have this YA book, you've written a children's book, you've written some nonfiction. So what draws you to a project that makes you, you know, how do you know that it has the legs that we were talking about earlier? And does that process change at all across different genres versus, you know, across time?
Mm-hmm. I think to figure out if something has legs, it's, oh gosh, I think it's, my process is roughly the same, whatever I'm working on, whatever like genre, subgenre. So, you know, even my kid's book, which is Lady Miss Penny Goes to Lunch. And I probably revised that book, which is 750 words. I probably rewrote that book more than like I've done novels. It was just worked on and revised. And it, you know, it suffered from like multiple different editors for, you know, that's one of those things that happens in publishing.
Yeah.
And everyone had their take. And so it's not a word count thing. It's just, what are you working on? How well do you do it? What do your partners with it say and want from it? So it's worked and worked over. My YA book, Alice and Gabby's Excellent Adventure, I started that thinking I was going to write 2 romance novels that were connected and I was going to self-publish them, but you had to read one to get the other. Like, and then what, as I wrote it, I realized, oh no, I plotted one thing, but this is actually the story of these two girls' friendships.
Yeah.
And I probably started that book in like 2015 and it was never under contract. It was just this like fun side project I did for myself. And so every few years I would like pull it out and work on it more and pull it out and work on it more and go back to the start and revise it. And you know, when you can see something with fresh eyes,
yeah,
it, you bring so much more to it. So, it was the same process as like a historical romance novel, but just stretched out over years.
Yeah.
So I don't even remember your original question. How do I know if something has legs?
Yeah. Like across, you know, and how do you pick, how do you know like, oh, well, this contemporary is something that I think is a good use of my time right now, or this YA or this, you know, versus like this historical. Obviously, like contracts make a big difference because somebody gives you a due date and like you can't be like, well, I'm going to work on this contemporary now.
Yeah. You know?
Screw you. You'll get it when you get it. They get mad about that.
Yeah. And you don't get your money.
Yeah.
I think the main question the writer has to ask is there enough conflict?
Yeah.
Because if there's enough conflict, that like then it will have legs. Then you will hit your word count. Then you will like tell your story. Like you won't have these like sagging middles or like other problems that befall a manuscript. And then sometimes like you're writing something and you're like, I don't know if this has legs, but yeah, it's under contract, so I'm going to give it legs.
Yeah.
Which is its own perversely fun kind of challenge where you're like, I'm going to make this work. Yep. And it's going to work by June. Like,
yeah, it must work by June 14th.
Yeah. Come hell or high
water. Or someone comes to my house.
Yeah. Right. So, it's terrifying, but also, in its weird way, kind of fun. I don't necessarily recommend it. But every book is different. And so I think every book is different. And at the end of the day, it's like, did you sit down and put words on the page?
Yeah.
If you can do that, you can work with anything. You can figure it out.
Yeah. It does feel like that there's a path. Once there's a completed project, there's a path and I can find it if I haven't found it during the process of writing, which hopefully I have. Because you're right, it is terrifying, but it is kind of fun. You know, the challenges, especially sometimes in retrospect, seem fun. Sometimes not when you're in the middle of them, but in retrospect, they seem fun.
Yeah, yeah. So
you've made some pretty, I mentioned it in the introduction, pretty passionate defenses of romance, including your 2015 book, Dangerous Books for Girls. We used to just have these bad takes limited to February, you know, Valentine's Day would come and everyone would be like, let's bag on romance this month. But it kind of feels like now it's like a year round thing. Like, oh my God, it's like September and someone is saying, Fabio, like I'm not ready. My body is not ready for this. So why do you think that this is this constant revolving door of the discourse? And do you think that it is changing, because I mean, it does seem like occasionally you get a really good one now, which I don't feel like we used to get. So,
yeah. So much has changed for romance and pop culture for the better since mm-hmm. 2015. So much had even changed from when I wrote like Dangerous Books for Girls started as my master's thesis, and it was a very dry academic thing because it was a master's thesis. And then when I went to expand it as more of like an essay collection, I was like, oh, this is already starting to change. Good, but shit, like I'm writing this book. So romance and pop culture has changed so much more for the better. Mm-hmm. We get reviewed in so many more places. I mean, we're reviewed in the New York Times now.
Yeah.
We, Bridgerton, are getting adapted for bigger distribution, for TV, for screen, all of these things. We get those think pieces year-round, not just around February. Unfortunately, we're still getting the bodice ripping and Fabio crap.
It's exhausting.
It's unoriginal at this point. like do well, better.
It's so lazy because like Fabio hasn't been on a romance cover in 20 years. Like,
right.
Like we're like four generations past Fabio. Like I have gone to LA and shot and I have never had Fabio as an option. Not that I would want him as an option.
Right. Right.
Like this is not, I mean, it's not, it's like, oh, you know, that is what is so frustrating is, you know, I mean, you have so many people that are readers of romance that can critically speak about, because honestly, we have a lot to be critical about in our genre. We mm-hmm. have a lot that can, that you could make a critical argument about what is and isn't wrong with the genre. And people have written those. But I mean, like, to sit there and say Bodice Ripper and Fabio, it's like, you haven't read a romance novel probably ever, but if you have, it's like you read one in 1982. Like, how right. do you not think that the genre has changed in 40 years? Like, what like, why?
Why?
See, I'm so angry, I can't even process, like, the actual language for this.
It's really infuriating because, like, sometimes when I'm feeling generous, I think, well, these people are on these, like, crazy deadlines to get, like, a stupid web article up.
Sure.
They're like not paid much enough money, like whatever. But at the same time, it's like editors, there's plenty of smart, romance, savvy, knowledgeable people who can like write the story way better, just as fast or whatever. So, I don't know why it persists, with the Fabio and the Bodice Ripper stuff. I've kind of like made this commitment to myself where like, I'm just not saying those things anymore when I write pieces about it. But yeah. But it is lazy on the part of all these think pieces that just don't do their research.
Well, yeah, I mean, like they overlook like a writer like Carly Lane Perry, who, you know, mm-hmm. is, you know, kind of publicly like, I will write your think pieces, please. We're getting close to February. Please call me. I mean, right. this is someone who actually reads in our genre. And again, like, it isn't that I don't want a critical look at the genre, but I want that critical look from an insider, not from someone who looked at covers, you know, from 1978 and said, mm-hmm. this is what's in the book, you know,
right.
who's never right. read a book that came out within the last 3 years, who's never read an indie book, who's never read widely across the many subgenres of our genre,
right.
you know, who's never read diversely within our genre, and then wants to make a comment about it, you know, versus, you know, I mean, when an insider says, here's our problem, like, I'm very happy to read those things and have those discussions and be a part of those discussions. We've had those discussions on this podcast. So it's not that I don't think any of us don't want to have a critical view, but I just don't want yeah. a critical view from someone that doesn't know what the hell they're talking about.
I agree. Like, no one wants me to write about football for all these right? reasons.
Exactly. And that's what's crazy. If someone came to me and said, I want to give you $1 million to write a critical piece about football. Maybe $1 million. I mean, let me rethink that. But like, you know, I mean, if someone said, I want to give you whatever, I don't know what a going rate is for a good going rate for writing something like that. I would say, I don't know anything about football. Why are you asking me?
Do you know what it probably is though? Like $300.
There you go. $300 I would definitely pass up because I wouldn't feel like qualified.
Right. I think it's, you know, I don't want to excuse it. But I think there's a lot of like structural stuff there that prevents getting like really good, thoughtful things. But at the same time, it's like there's also so many smart, savvy, knowledgeable people who would be better equipped to write these pieces. But it's also, we get back to that blind spot, right? Like, why doesn't an editor think to one cover romance? Why don't they ask one of these people? Well, they don't know them, or are their friends not, are there people in their network not open about that they're really smart romance readers? Or a lot of people have this idea of like, oh, I know romance. I really love Gone with the Wind, right? Like they yeah. think they yes. know it, but they don't.
You know what's a great romance? Romeo and Juliet and Nicholas Sparks. And I'm like, oh no, we can't talk anymore. I don't want exactly. to see you. Like, cause you don't, so cause again, like it's like all of the signals are telling me you don't know what you are talking about.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, like there's, this huge misconception of whatever the intelligence level is of those of us who are writing it, whatever the intelligence level is of those who are reading it. And I mean, it's so crazy to me, the disconnect, because you look at just looking at the numbers, the billion-dollar industry that we are in, you cannot have a billion-dollar industry without a whole lot of really smart people.
Exactly. It's a math problem. And the smartest people I've met have been in romance.
They have so many lawyers. So many lawyers.
Well, I went to some, I'm always like,
should I have been a lawyer? Because I feel like maybe that's, did I miss a prerequisite?
I know. Well, I remember going to give a talk at a local chapter conference, and we all went out to lunch after, and you know, it's the most normal looking group of women, and we went to whatever sports bar, and it's all whatever, so normal. And then you're talking about everybody's day jobs, and it's like, oh, I'm an astrophysicist, I'm a ship captain. It's like, of course you are. That's what romance is, besides all the lawyers and the doctors. And but also I want everyone to have that perception of romance, but also for all the romance writers and readers who aren't astrophysicists or ship captains or lawyers or anything else, or just that's great too. And that,
right, there's no higher value to that.
There's no higher value. Their intelligence is their intelligence, and no one deserves to have their love of reading slagged off.
Yep.
I think what bothers me more is the dismissal of women's interests and desire and pleasure and things that give them hope and get them through the day. I think that that bothers me more than, I don't know, any Fabio thing or...
Yeah. It's been really interesting during the pandemic. The pandemic has been a very interesting study for me in just watching the way that the readership has spoken about the value of romance. Like, there are so many people that are saying romance novels are what are getting them through this. Mm-hmm. Frontline people have said this to me, that reading, you have faced things that no human being should have to face, and you face them 16 times a day, 20 times a day, 100 times a day. And whatever that horrific thing is, whatever job you're doing, whether it's, you're the bagging groceries or you're a ER physician, everyone who is forced to go out into this and forced to continue and put themselves in danger is facing things that are very scary every day. And so many of them have said, I come home and I shower in 500 degree water, and then I read my romance for half an hour, and that's how I sleep. And that has such enormous value. It makes me go, okay, then I have to keep going, because if that's the only thing that I ever provide in the world is having someone feel happy for 5 minutes after a horrible day, whatever that horrible day is, it doesn't have to just be pandemic, and letting them sleep, then I've provided a good service to this world that I'm proud of.
I come back to the same thought. We are the luckiest writers in the world, where we get to put out that relaxation, that hope, that hand-holding, that feeling that helps everybody else keep going on. And it's an honor to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And oh, thank goodness. I think the other thing romance brings right now is to people is it ends.
Yeah.
And it ends well. When we're in this just long slog of
the ending isn't guaranteed.
What the hell is
And the ending isn't guaranteed. None of us know how this is going to go. I was just speaking to my neighbor. We moved to this neighborhood a year ago, and so we're still getting to know all of our neighbors, because it's obviously been a little bit harder in the pandemic. But this lady has a dog that my dog is best friends with her dog. Her dog I don't know that he wants to be best friends with my dog, but my dog is very enthusiastic about his friendship. And, she had said, we were talking and she found out what I did. And that's all. Isn't that always you're like, oh God, here I go, bracing myself. How are you going to react? She was like, oh, I'm going to buy a book. I'm like, oh, yay. I'm so excited for that. But she saw me yesterday and she said, oh, I read the book and I was so glad it ended well. do any of them end badly? And I was like, no. Not a one. Like, if you read a book from the romance genre and it ends badly, the person has violated the promise of the genre. So 99.99% of people that put their books in the romance genre know that, and they're properly finishing a book, right, for our genre. And so if you're looking for hope and you're looking for something that's going to make you feel good, you can trust this. And watching the relief come over her face, I was like, okay, that's good. I've tricked you. I brought you in. First taste was not free. She just went and bought it. But like, mm-hmm. I gave you a gateway. So I hope she's going to go read a whole bunch of romance to make herself feel better.
She will.
Yeah. Well, if you've asked that question, then you already want to know the answer. What you're telling me is I would like to not be scared that it's not going to be okay. Because right now I'm already scared it's not going to be okay. So I want to feel that, you know, and if I want to feel that, and if I can create that for somebody else, then that's like worth all of it. It's worth all of the like going uphill both ways with the wind 45 miles an hour and freezing cold in your face. If I get to the end and somebody goes, that was like the book, that was the best book I've read, or that was the best book you've written, or that book made me so happy, then that was worth the whatever pain there was, generating it. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, happiness.
I know. And that's like a super good way to end our hour. So how does that time always fly? Like every single time I do this with people, because I think it's just because it's so exciting to talk to other writers. But do you have something that you want to tell? What do you want them to go by? If there's something coming up, whatever you want to tell them about.
Well, thank you. My website is mayarodale.com. And I have, as my next release, Alice and Gabby's Excellent Adventure. It totally ends well. It totally ends happily. It's a total fluffy escape. So that's coming out soon. I'm also working on a historical fiction novel about Nellie Bly. Bringing all my romance tricks and skills to that story. So that's what I'm working on now. Updates on my website. I'm at Maya Rodale on all the socials. And I've really enjoyed talking to you, Jess.
Yeah, it was so fun. I'm so glad you could do this.
Me too. And thank you for giving us all this chance to hear how everyone else works and how they get it done.
It's my favorite thing. I'm so excited that I get to do it.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.